Welcome to the Last Rush Hour podcast. I'm your host, Fred Pilot, author of the recently published ebook, Last Rush Hour, The Decentralization of Knowledge Work in the 21st Century. If you've ever wondered that someday soon you would no longer need to waste time commuting to and from the office and the rush hour would become a thing of the past, the ebook and this podcast are for you. Today, with modern information and communications technology, knowledge work, analyzing data, reading reports, writing and producing presentations, planning and strategizing, and collaborating with colleagues and clients can be done anywhere with a reliable internet connection and whenever one can think, communicate, and be creative and productive. Knowledge workers and their organizations have begun migrating out of the commute and office space. People are increasingly working somewhere all of the time in home offices or in their communities. Some organizations have gone fully virtual, operating without the major expense of dedicated office space. Each podcast will feature a conversation with a notable individual influencing and driving this major shift in how we work in the 21st century information economy. This episode's guest is Mika Cross. Mika is a federal workplace policy strategist specializing in work-life balance, diversity, inclusion, and employee engagement, and currently serves as Director of Strategic Communications, Digital, and Public Engagement with the U.S. Department of Labor, Veterans Employment and Training Services. Mika's been in federal service as a civilian since 2002. She also served with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau earlier in 2015, actually, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, the United States Department of Agriculture, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. She's also had a military career in the U.S. Army. Mika, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you're very prominent on LinkedIn. You're kind of like the federal go-to person on telework. How did you get involved in telework so heavily as you have?
Well, that's interesting. As you mentioned, I sort of made my way across government, and I've had the pleasure of working in many different areas, which really allows me to dig deep into the culture of different federal agencies. So the first federal agency I worked at as a civilian was in the United States intelligence community. Well, it was after 9/11, and the focus was really around knowledge sharing, collaboration, but also how are we going to do things differently as a government, especially in that intimate community on behalf of national intelligence. So I was working in human capital policy at the time, and also, incidentally, was a new mom. So having experienced that myself of thinking about what work-life integration at the time, work-life balance, and now what we're calling work-life blend meant for me personally, but also how we could tie in smarter ways of working to the efficiencies and the strategies around better ways of working overall for the intelligence community was something that I really felt passionate about just from a personal perspective. So I had a hand in helping to shape and update policies that used to be called FlexiPlates at the time, more than a decade and a half ago, but especially thinking about how would those policies affect organizations that had workers who were tied to a workplace that by design and by nature of the mission really had an impetus to stay on site. Also keeping in mind that that was a blended work environment, which included civilian employees, a large portion of federal contractors, and joint military service members from across all different components. So how would this think about adopting mobile modern workplace practices when the majority of their work was done on site by virtue of the fact that, it resided in national intelligence? And so what that really forced us to do from a policy perspective in human capital was think about creative ways of implementing it. So thinking about how, at the time it was called FlexiPlates again, not telework yet, but how FlexiPlates and telecommuting could be adopted in an environment where our folks all had top secret clearances, where the level of clearances required that you work on specialized computer equipment, which could only be done, of course, in the building, and how they might think about maybe using some of their non-classified administrative type job duties in an offsite environment, even if it were only for a portion of a duty day. So that's really where I got my start. From there, I moved over to the United States Department of Agriculture, and at the time, it was right after the Telework Enhancement Act was enacted into legislation and law in 2010 when I joined USDA. and the Secretary of Agriculture was really committed to what he called cultural transformation. So that initiative really was about, again, finding efficient ways of working on behalf of the American public, but also encouraging a highly engaged, highly efficient type of workforce that could get ahead of the change rather than be managed by it. And also encourage things on the human capital side of the house with regards to recruitment, retention, diversity, and inclusion of talent, regardless of where that talent resided, for the betterment of government. So that's kind of where I got my start in a long answer to your short question.
Okay. Well, where is the does the federal government's telework effort stand today in 2016? I know there's been some policy. I looked at the telework.gov website, and I see that there was policy going back to the early 90s, actually, encouraging agencies to adopt telework. So there's been a policy history there that's been playing out over a long period of time. But here we are in 2016. I'm just trying to give our listeners a picture of where things stand with the federal government today.
Yeah, well, it's been an interesting transformation, really, because, you know, the genesis of telework used to be sort of thought of as a soft benefit, just another flexible workplace program that was considered a nice to have, but not really a necessity, not really an important facet of how government does business. And since the Telework Enhancement Act of 2010, and then additionally, since other legislation has come down the pike with regards to the Data Act, with regards to continuity of operations, and thinking about just the world that we live in, federal agencies have really put a focus on how can we do business better? How can we continue operations when unpredictable circumstances, you know, including inclement weather, like right now I'm sitting in the middle of a snowstorm blizzard. and I'm able to continue working because of the focus on continuity. So the shift really moved from sort of family-friendly workplace policies that really, really didn't push business leaders to think about how that could affect government in a really important way with regards to efficient ways of working, to more of a business imperative so that, you know, there are management efficiencies found, reducing office space, significantly increasing costs. And guess what? You know, we're being accountable to the government, or to the American public, rather, which government should be doing, and being able to deliver services and continue operations when otherwise the traditional office would be unaccessible, or maybe there's a power outage or a problem with, you know, computer connectivity. So for those missions that aren't hinged on security clearances or special operations or special kind of computer equipment, they are able to, and the majority of them, now over 70% eligible in the federal space, are able to continue working. And so that really drives more efficient ways of working and accountability.
Well, isn't there a report that's due from OPM, Office of Personnel Management, on implementation of the Telework Enhancement Act? Isn't that due about now?
Or? Yes. Actually, those reports are annual. And so agencies are accountable for responding to OPM in what's called a telework data call every single year. It covers the number of eligible workers, how many people are actually assigned to that federal agency or SD, how many that agency considers as eligible to telework. And that means all forms of telework, whether that's on a situational project-based basis or a more regular fixed schedule. And then requirements to report the number of folks that have telework agreements in place and that are actually on different kinds of telework agreements. That does get reported annually and folded up into an annual report to Congress that OPM submits.
Well, isn't there one due about now, or can you give our listeners some idea where things stand in terms of compliance and implementation of that legislation?
Of the Telework Enhancement Act?
Well, yes.
You know, agencies have been plugging along for a while. The first requirement was to get really all of the stipulations completed successfully within 6 months of the enactment. So people had until June of 2011 to complete things like mandatory training for supervisors and teleworkers to ensure that everybody who was teleworking was on a signed telework agreement. And there were some other stipulations there as well. Notification of eligibility, that was one that was outlined in the Telework Enhancement Act. And so at this point, agencies are really pretty much in compliance with that piece of it. Now I think OPM is really looking federally, government-wide, on how telework can be used and trying to leverage some of those best practices from agencies that are doing really great things You know, you have examples of agencies that are able to save, you know, millions of dollars in transportation subsidies because of their telework projection. You have employee engagement scores increasing because of regular recurring telework agreements. And so those things in that report help keep agencies accountable, but also help highlight some of those best practices so that as other federal agencies look to adopt telework strategies more and more, they're able to sort of, figure out what works best for others that might be like comprised or like organized. And so that's pretty helpful.
How many, can you give us some idea in terms of how many federal workers are working in their communities versus commuting into the downtown office in D.C., for example?
Yeah, I think last I saw, there was a neat infographic that was reported in 2014. I haven't the 2015 data yet, but it was over 34% of employees who were federal employees who were eligible for telework and teleworking more than 2 or 3 days a week. So that's a pretty substantial number compared to where they started with. And even when I was at USDA, I mean, we saw market increases in the numbers of employees, and that's an organization that was over 100,000 deep, you know, all around the world and 3,000 different facilities across the country, really increasing their adoption of telework.
It's somewhat of a management issue, or actually not somewhat, probably more than somewhat, but we have to learn a new management method, don't we, in terms of managing employees that aren't all in a central office.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's nice is that you're now seeing sort of a blend and a focus on how technology and human capital policy and leadership training and development are all sort of coming together to really bridge the gap of that culture piece that was missing before. And then you also have, you know, the impetus to put telework strategy in place for continuity planning, which is also a requirement for federal agencies to do. So telework has to be folded into the overall continuity of government, continuity of operations strategy and strategic planning also. So there are drills that are preparing people to understand how to work better. IT and some agencies are working to, you know, right when someone walks in the door, issue mobile devices and teach them how to remote access into their desktop and access share folders and be able to collaborate a little bit better. And as the federal IT department drive follower production, you have the technology that enables you to stay connected, accessible, and available, and collaborate with your team members more, it drives a higher level of comfort and a higher level of accountability for managers who might traditionally have felt like, well, out of sight is out of mind.
Excuse me. Yeah, that has been a big issue, the management by sight. And we're having to learn a new way of managing that doesn't involve necessarily eyeballing people, but looking at their work, basically. What are they producing, and what's the quality of that?
Absolutely. I mean, and what's nice to see is that telework helps drive that. So, again, what used to be thought of as a soft benefit, nice to have, well, that's an employee morale program, which only some people can participate in it. It's really driving other kinds of efficiencies across government to include leadership competencies. And when you're looking at workforce that now has to adopt worker capabilities with regards to technology usage and familiarity, and thinking about having to do more with less, this really does help leverage the ability to get the job to where the talent is, overcome and mitigate hidden barriers to employment for women and minorities and individuals with disabilities. If you think about returning military veterans and their caregivers or spouses, you know, telework and virtual work and remote work can help offer employment to people that otherwise wouldn't have access to. So these are all sort of transforming the way that the government is doing work now. And what's nice is it's driving a higher level of accountability in adopting a performance-based culture. So again, going back to that accountability piece, you know, on behalf of the American public, when you are not managing by line of sight, you're having to really set clear deadlines, clear expectations, and hold people accountable for doing such. And that really just helps to drive better ways of working overall.
That seems to be the real challenge, isn't it? Just learning to manage like that. There's so much of it isn't done that way.
It is. And then, you know, on the flip side, you know, let's give some credit to managers who are trying to give choice to their employees. You know, people that quite frankly just choose not to opt into telework. They have a preference preference not to work from home, or they want to keep a clear divide between work and home boundaries. And so thinking about that also, it sort of forces a manager or a leader to think about giving choice and offering some trust and autonomy to a workforce, which in turn drives employee engagement and productivity. It drives retention, and it drives show.
That's a good point you raise about not everybody wants to opt in. And there was a guest I had on a previous podcast named Michael Shear, and he is proposing a distributed work model where you have, for example, an office in Fairfax, Virginia for federal employees from any number of agencies that would go to that center and work there, because they may not have they may not have a suitable place in their home to work from home, or certainly a coffee shop may not be a good environment either for a lot of people. So are you seeing anything like that going on in the federal government in the D.C. area, where there's this use of these distributed satellite centers?
Well, it's interesting because GSA, the General Services Administration, used to actually operate these shared telecommuting centers. It's interesting that Michael would say that, because they were really highly underutilized, and people chose not to go in, so they actually shut them down in the D.C. metropolitan area. So that's an interesting thought. I think the preference of most people is to work from their home. You know, people are most comfortable there. They can use, in some agencies, their own non-government equipment, which means they could, in turn, in theory, maybe be a little more efficient, because they're more familiar with kind of a laptop or that kind of computer configuration. The other thing that telework does is sort of drive a shared responsibility concept in both employee and the organization. So that, you know, it's not just on the onus of the organization to make telework successful and hold their leadership accountable for allowing telework, but also accountability for the teleworker to do what they're supposed to do. You know, again, to sort of demonstrate that results can be made and that they're held accountable for the work, regardless of where they work from. And so if you socialize this idea of a shared responsibility, then employees understand, hey, you know, yeah, my agency might not be funding a portion of my payment of my Wi-Fi, when they're not paying to give me a landline, or they haven't offered a stipend for a printer. But guess what? You're getting off the road a couple days a week, which saves you time, which is one of the most, I think, underutilized premiums that employees sometimes forget about. So,
well, it seems to be enormous, because we're seeing a lot of there's a lot of discussion in human resource and management circles about work-life balance and time. We seem to be in a time famine, according to the one book author I was looking at on LinkedIn this morning.
Oh, Bridget Schulte.
Yes, right, the time famine, right. So,
I mean, absolutely. I mean, and think about, you know, with constrained resources, right? We are not able to hire as many when one walks out the door in a federal space. Maybe you have to wait for three to walk out the door before you can hire one. And so what are the costs and the tax on an individual's well-being also when asked to do more with less? So telework also offers a strategy for giving back some time. And it studies show, in fact, you know, Kate Lister, you had as a guest, her research and data really points to the fact that teleworkers give even more time and are even more productive than their in-office counterparts, because you're reducing the commute. So often you'll find teleworkers happily giving more time to getting work done, because they're doing it in their workplace and they don't have to worry about, you know, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours from each way. So sometimes those are the little spillover benefits that people often don't think about.
That's interesting. You should point that out, because the commute time is your personal time, whereas if you're working remotely and you're not making that commute, you're saying that people will go the extra mile for their employer, for their organization, because, you know, they are able to access their work easy there, where they're not, you know, they're not being asked to sacrifice that long commute time, you know, so they'll go a little.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely right. In fact, you know, even myself as a single parent of two, when I'm in the office in D.C., if I have a 5 p.m. pickup and then I have activities in the afternoon, I have to try to find a way to manage my time, other people putting meetings on my calendar, and being responsive to my team there in office while trying to leave by 3:30. You know, and is that really reasonable? Because otherwise, I can't get to them. Versus I'm working from home, and in my home office, I might be able to work until 4:45. And because their school is 10 minutes away, I put down the work and go grab them. And I, maybe in theory, I've been working since, you know, 7 a.m. So I'm able to give more to my work because I have less of a constraint on my time.
Yeah, I mean, you have a more positive attitude towards it. It's like, okay, you're able to go that extra mile, whereas if you're sitting on a grinding commute, you know, you tend to develop more of a negative attitude towards your work. You know, it's like, oh, this is such a burden, time-wise, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, and then, you know, people are tired, and
sure,
they're not sleeping well, and all of these kind of wellness implications also. And the work doesn't go away, but, you know, if you have a commute that requires you to think ahead an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending upon traffic on any given day, you're having to cut it down and shut down quicker than you would if you were able to just have that flexibility in place too.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the wellness issue. I'm actually working on a paper on that topic. And that's another mm-hmm. deficit we seem to be having in the United States today is a wellness deficit. People aren't getting enough time to unwind and to relax and to exercise. It all seems to be somewhat connected here because we have what I would consider a public health crisis in chronic conditions. People are not putting in enough time to be active. They're so sedentary, you know, you're sitting 8 hours in an office all day. And I've done this myself, and I know firsthand it has adverse health effects. It's not very good. And you need more time than just to walk around the block. I mean, some organizations say, oh, we'll just walk around the office a few times and call it good. But, you know, we'll do that once a week, and it's really not going to get you much in the way of benefit in terms of sustained exercise.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. That wellness implication is so strong. In fact, you know, at USDA, we really pushed, you know, your employee wellness program in tandem with telework, which meant thinking about even the implications that say for nursing moms, especially if you're a new nursing mom. Mm-hmm. You know, if there is a constraint on the lactation room availability, you know, it's a premium time during lunch, and new moms aren't able to get there because there's a long walk from one building to another or one side of town to another. You know, if they were leveraging telework, they'd be able to sort of do both. And you know, it's not a substitute for caregiving. It's not a substitute for doing things other than work. But at the same time, thinking about how many times a day do your employees, you know, go and take a lunch break or a coffee break or maybe even get breakfast in the morning or chat, you know, over a snack with their colleagues or what have you. You know, again, thinking about things differently, managers don't have to be worried about, oh, it's work. That's not the case. And we're not suggesting that they substitute official duty time with anything else other than work. But it's not realistic to think that your employees, even when in office, are sitting there for 8 straight hours a day being productive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we're getting to this point where, you know, we have these large metro areas that were created in the industrial age, you know, where you have a downtown center, everybody went to work downtown. And, you know, Washington, D.C. is an example of that. You have a huge growing metro area there with all the workers living on the outside of the area, on the outside of the circle and commuting into the center every day. And we're seeing the same thing in metro areas like Los Angeles, Atlanta, the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm wondering if we're reaching a point where the center just doesn't hold anymore. It's this, the access to jobs, and this is something Michael Shearer has brought up, the access to jobs in the center is becoming so costly in terms of time and money that it's the center is basically not holding as well anymore as it used to. It's just too difficult to get there. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I certainly think that there's merit to that point of view. In fact, there are some states that are really faced with a challenge of the brain drain. You know, my home state is one of them, Maine. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a lack or shortage of jobs, people, once they get their higher level education, are leaving. And what if, in fact, the jobs could come to them? And you begin to think about things differently. In fact, you're able to mitigate some of those socioeconomic barriers that traditionally exist too. In fact, it's funny, I read a research paper once that cited equal opportunity and civil rights claims went down when managers and hiring managers interviewed virtually over the phone versus in person. And they made a selection based on true merit and how the person did in a phone interview, similar to what we're doing right now, you and I, and hired virtually. The cost for locality pay or relocation and that sort of thing went down for those organizations as well. So, yeah, when you're thinking about the war on talent and talent acquisition strategy, it makes good business sense. And that's for positions that can be done that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about out of time for today. I wanted to thank you for being on the podcast and
you're holing up in a huge blizzard that's coming in today. So you have an enjoyable weekend, and thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Thank